You're listening to Transforming Insight, the podcast for anyone who has the ambition to transform their insight team and create an insight-driven organization. Your host is James Witcherly, Chief Executive of the Insight Management Academy and the author of the book Transforming Insight, The 42 Secrets of Successful Corporate Insight Teams.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Transforming Insight podcast. This is episode 79, and we're calling it Bigger Than Biscuits. Welcome back, everybody. Great to have you listening once again. As many of you will know, this season and this year, the Transforming Insight podcast, we're using the outline of the 9 P's of the Insight Leaders Playbook, my latest book that was published back in March. But in between episodes that focus just on the messages in the book, we've invited a group of senior insight leaders to talk about their experience and share their views on topics related to the chapter that we've just been talking about. So back in episode 71, we had Ruth Hinton and James Endersby talking about their views on how agencies and client-side market research teams can work more effectively together, because that tied in with our partnerships episode. Then we had Nick Rich talking about his latest venture, the Growth Constructors, and how that tied in with Insight Team's priorities and thinking about things, all things commercial. And in the 2 episodes after that, Claire Goff talking about her views on an Insight Team's product set and how we all need to refresh and review our product set from time to time, just like a major retailer needs to review the product set that it's got out there, or FMCG organization. So that's what we're going to do today. In the last episode, episode 78, we talked about P for performance, how an insight team thinks about its performance, how you know whether you've had a good year or not, whether you do that on a backwards looking view or whether you think about the foundations that you're laying for the future. And in thinking about this topic, I was thinking about Suzanne and Danny, who have been talking to me a number of times recently about a project that they just launched called Bigger Than Biscuits. I'm going to ask them to tell you all about it in a moment. But for those of you outside the UK, Danny Russell, I know from many years back when Danny was head of Insight at Sky and O2 and one of the earliest members of the Insight Forum that you've heard us talking about many times over. And likewise, Suzanne Lothart, who has been both eBay and Rightmove and other organisations, again, associated with the IMA. So it's my pleasure to welcome you to the podcast today, guys. And with that, tell us about your project.
Oh, well, thanks for having us, James. Bigger Than Biscuits is a campaign or a mission. And the mission is to change the mindset of C-suite, to stop thinking about market research as a cost it can cut, but see it very much as an investment for the future. And to do that through empiric research, which demonstrates that market research actually makes you money. So we're taking inspiration from a number of different places. So it all started a few years back. My background is in media research. So I've worked with advertising and media people for many, many years. And I know from that experience that whenever there was a recession, and I've lived through at least 2 of them, that there's always a marketing playbook out there that says, in times of recession, keep spending and your brand will come out the other side stronger. So when COVID hit, I was thinking, wouldn't it be great if market research had one of those? And we don't have it. We don't have the evidence. So the evidence that the marketing industry's got comes from people like Binet and Field with the long and the short of it. It even comes from organizations like Thinkbox that do a great job marketing their medium. They've got a fantastic story to tell. And so it's been on my mind for a little while. And then chatting to Danny, you know, you just get to the point, let's just do this thing, because we know that if marketing's got a great story to tell, then in part of that story, market research will play a part. So we've got a story to tell, but we just need to get out there and tell it. So that's kind of where it came from.
So quick question before we go further. Talk about market research here. By that, do I take it that you mean insight more broadly? So we're thinking about things like customer analysis, market share analysis, competitor intelligence, or are we thinking very specifically about sort of survey research?
Everything. It's the stuff that feeds the innovation pipeline. It's the stuff that feeds the creative platform development. It's all the work we do. I mean, it's even stuff like customer experience research. It's anything that can help us diagnose a problem in a business so they can go and do something that will put it all right. So it's the full spectrum. And the Bigger Than Biscuits remit is actually global. You know, we appreciate that the challenges that market researchers face in terms of headcount, pressures of time, pressures on budget, that they're universal. They're not just UK problems. So the whole premise behind this is to build an evidence base that's compelling, that tells lots of great stories about the power of market research to generate revenue, and how it can do that across categories and, you know, around the world.
Fabulous. And a timely thing that you talk about it, you know, during COVID, the irony was that there was an increase in spend on insight and learning and development around insight and insight capability in the 2 or 3 years post-COVID. But as we've drawn attention to on the podcast a number of times recently, real series of sort of disruptors taking place in, well, across insight, but in the corporate insight world in particular, with the headcount freezes, budget restrictions at the moment, a lot of senior insight people having left their roles and insight teams not having the resources to draw on, just at the time when the appetite for people within the organisation to ask the insight team for support seems to be higher than ever.
Yeah, I mean, we've been following the IPA bellwether report for several years, and in classic insight sector ways, rather than looking at the outputs, there was a lot of sort of criticism of it in terms of, well, it only talks to CMOs and it's only 300 people per quarter. And we immediately turned to picking at the methodology. Even if it's 50% wrong, the IPA bellwether report is not happy reading for market research. The last data that I could find from the Worldwide Federation of Advertisers said something like 2/3 of insight teams report in through the CMO. Now, obviously, it's not going to apply to everybody, and there's, you know, some will report into finance and some will report into strategy. But there's no doubt that the CMO is a major stakeholder, even if they're not the direct report of our outputs. And as I say, if the IPA bellwether report is 50% wrong, I'm still worried, because it's been showing, you know, 8 out of the last 10 quarters that they're just not focusing on market research. They would put that money elsewhere. As you mentioned, James, there's other threats that are coming along. Let's get the AI out there early on, because it is an issue. And we know, because we talk about it constantly amongst ourselves, we know that AI is not a direct replacement for what we do. However, there are definitely stakeholders out there who start to see AI as a faster, better, cheaper way of getting information, getting what they might call insight. Again, we will pick up the methodology of it. They will sit there and think, I can pretty much get an 80% answer within 2 minutes. And I worry about that. And I know there's lots of people sort of, oh, it's not going to be a problem, it won't be a problem. I do worry about that.
Yeah, I think, well, I've talked a number of times on this podcast, and also when I've been on stage recently at Quirks, and most recently at the Get Why Insights Summit over in Copenhagen, and on a webinar for Rival Technologies a couple of weeks ago, about the extent to which I think we need to focus on the politics as well as the practicalities of AI. I think the great opportunities that it will bring for insight teams if properly harnessed. But while we're learning more about those opportunities, there's a real danger that we'll have a repeat of what I think happened with big data, where insight teams that focused too narrowly on one particular set of data or one particular methodology or discipline weren't able to extend what they did to incorporate new sources of information and potential sources of intelligence, and sort of lost the debate within their organizations and found that major, you know, analytics departments, decision science departments were set up outside of the traditional insight sphere. And frankly, a lot of organizations have spent 10 years trying to join things back together in terms of understanding what's going on and getting one sort of single view of the truth. I think if that happened with big data, then its potential to happen with AI, you know, is far greater. Mm-hmm. So, Bigger Than Biscuits. I know you're itching to tell me more about some of the case studies that you've gathered and the way, the methodology that you're going to apply. But do you want to tell us a little bit about why the project is called that in the first place?
So, Bigger Than Biscuits is, it's slightly tongue-in-cheek, but there's a very serious message to it. So, a couple of years ago, the Market Research Society in the UK did some work looking at the value of market research as a sector to the economy. And it's a really useful piece of work for policy making and to demonstrate, you know, what we're giving back in terms of GDP. And when it's talked about, people say, oh, you know, it's market research is £9 billion is spent on market research, and that makes us bigger than biscuits and bigger than a number of other industries. And whilst that's useful on one level, I think in terms of the story that we as an industry need to tell, it may not be the right way of telling it. Because 9 billion, of course, is how much is spent on market research. And if you're a cynical CFO or a CMO that doesn't really believe in market research, you'll just go, oh my God, that's a lot of money being wasted. So the difference between that work and what we're doing, and what we're doing is sort of extending that, is we're saying, well, let's take that £9 billion and let's show you what you can achieve with it. So what's the value that you derive from that £9 billion investment rather than simply seeing it as a cost? So it sort of started as a slightly tongue-in-cheek thing, and then we got some professional advice from someone that knows a lot about advertising who just said, no, keep the name, I love it, it's catchy. And I think in lots of ways it is quite catchy, but it's kind of building on that industry research to say how much we contribute to GDP, but then taking that one step further and saying, but look what we do with it, aren't we amazing? And we are.
Yeah. Yeah, it comes down to us starting to talk about quality rather than just quantity. The size of the biscuit industry is relatively interesting, but 9 billion is that a big number? Is it a small number? Is it going up? But more importantly, from the stakeholders that we see the most appeal, that we must appeal to, i.e. CEOs, CFOs and CMOs, we want to start talking to them about the output of what that 9 billion gives them. It's the quality of the work that we do. And as Suzanne mentioned earlier, we have a great story. And when we come together at conferences and awards, we're amazing at getting very excited about the work that we do because it is real good work. But we're not talking to anybody else, right? That story is not being shouted from the rooftops. And nobody else is going to tell that story other than ourselves. So this is an initiative for us to shout loud and proud about what we do. Not to ourselves, but to everybody else around the business. Importantly, those people that are making decisions in the business and also those people that are making decisions about budgets.
Yeah, I totally agree.
You're listening to the Transforming Insight podcast published by the Insight Management Academy, the world's leading authority on transforming corporate insight teams.
And of course, this ties in, I know both of you have been involved with the IMA for many years, and one of the founding principles, really. I think everything that Steve Wills and Sally Webb did with all three of us in some of those early conversations was to think about the commercial aspect of insight and to make the case that because spend on insight is always, as described, discretionary, then by definition, you can analyse the difference that it's made to a project when it's been applied versus when it's not. And we've consistently encouraged organisations, insight teams, to think about those outputs, as you describe, and to calculate, at least in an estimated way, what the largest of those projects have actually brought to bear, what the insight team's contribution has been to them. But I think it's true to say that it's a minority of insight teams that have ever embraced that in a consistent way. Some have very effectively and have used it to argue for more resources in their organization, for extra headcount, or to defend the resources that they've got when budgets are being cut. But it's certainly not universally the case that insight teams routinely keep a value log recording everything that they spend, both in terms of primary research spend or internal team time spend, particularly for analysis, and then understanding the, you know, the value uplift that's been seen as a result of the business activity that's followed that insight. So how easy have you found it to go and garner some great examples to get this project off the ground?
Well, quite difficult for all the reasons that Danny's mentioned. I mean, we've had a few people that have given us some absolute gems. And actually part of what we're doing at the moment is trying to encourage people to share more and to help them understand that what we're asking for isn't something that's going to get them locked up, isn't going to get them sacked. It's actually very low level bits of information and things that are fairly easily available. So we've been drawing a lot on marketing case studies, you know, the stuff that wins the Effies, because in the marketing and advertising world, they're brilliant at putting these papers together, and they seem somehow to manage to get all the really confidential information that people in market research don't seem to be able to get their hands on. So I've been trawling through the WARC database and finding some absolute gems, most of which talk about how insight was at the centre of it, and they give you loads of lovely numbers. But we know that they're the big, sexy brands, and we also know that there are lots of little things going on in companies around the country and around the world that are also delivering fantastic return on research investment. So part of our challenge at the moment is to get more people to contribute. So that's kind of why we're on this sort of education program to tell people what Biscuits is about, how they can help. And when Danny and I were talking about this last week, we were talking about how, you know, there are a couple of times when you talk about your successes from a commercial perspective. One is when you enter an award, and the other time, hopefully, is when you're in a job interview and somebody says, give me an example of some research that you did which delivered a commercial return. Now, if you're sitting in that job interview and you can't think of a single thing, then we would argue you might be in the wrong job. So those stories are there, but people just need the courage to let us work with them to get them out there.
And I think you mentioned that earlier, James, in terms of it doesn't have to be 2-3 decibel points. That's not the point. The point is that we have to assume that these very important stakeholders around the business, let's call it nicely, don't really understand, and let's be realistic and say they don't really care about the incredible work that we're doing, or the stresses that we're under, or the budgetary constraints, etc., because they've got their list of problems. And because of the types of people who work in our industry, and I think you've mentioned as well, I think the IMA are very, very good at this, always have been. I remember Steve and Sally talking about this. And I think the IMA attracts those companies that are actually doing this very, very well. But the initiative, Bigger Than Biscuits, is for us to help other people talk their own story and talk themselves up and tell everybody, allow people to know the great work that they're doing. It's interesting because we have found that as market researchers, we're quite shy and nervous about sort of ascertaining how much the market research eventually led to the commercial output. Like we tend to downplay our role. At the other end of the spectrum is the advertising world, who basically just go, no, it was all us. Like, this brand has tripled in revenue over the last 2 years, and it was all because of this amazing advert. And they all trip off to Cannes for 4 days or 5 days on the beach, constantly drinking champagne, just living it up. As Suzanne said, you know, some of these people, they're not introspectively kind of analyzing. They're just going, brilliant, we made this ad, the revenue's doubled over two, it's all down to us. And I think we're at the other end, and I don't think we'll ever get up to that extroverted nature of some of our advertising colleagues, but we definitely need to start moving up, because it doesn't have to be exact, and we have to be louder and prouder. We can't hide behind, because a lot of the successes of these business and these product launches and the geographical expansion is because of the insight that we are providing. We're not looking at for that as an exact science. And as Suzanne said, one of the best ways of thinking about it is, if you were in a job interview and somebody said, tell me about a piece of work that directly led to your business increasing its revenue or increasing its profit or reducing its churn, you would come up with that story. I really don't think a lot of people are going to sit there and go, no, actually, the work that I do is not that really important. There was a lot of other people involved and it wasn't really us. I think you would come forward and it's almost like, how do we help people communicate that story to an external world?
Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, the need to be commercial, to be commercially minded, runs through our insight work for me. We're focusing here quite rightly on the output. Now, what happens as, what's the business outcome, what proportion of that can insight sensibly, conservatively lay claim for in terms of the difference that was made because insight was involved? But if you don't know the value, for the size of the prize associated with the project, we shouldn't be doing the work in the first place. Mm. So the requirement to be commercial, to me, starts, you know, way upstream in terms of having some sort of a blueprint for your organization, understanding how customers interact with your company and how revenue is generated, how costs are generated, what the potential size of the prize associated with different projects that Insight could investigate looks like. Without that, you can't prioritize by value in the first place. But then you need a commercial context for every number that you see during a piece of work. And you certainly need to understand the potential commercial uplift at the recommendation stage if you want anybody to take notice of what we're doing. So in my way of thinking, what you're describing here follows on very naturally from that. It's just a question of having the confidence to follow up with stakeholders to find out, and what actually happened as a result of the research or the analysis, the insight work that we did.
Yeah.
And what proportion of that, in your estimation, as the decision maker, was down to the insight team. And it, frankly, it doesn't matter whether it was 15% or 20% or 25% in most cases, because if we're working on the biggest business issues in the first place, there will be so many zeros attached to those issues relative to the scale of the investment and research or analysis that the ROI is always going to look very impressive.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely true, James, because we're just thinking about one case study in particular that we've got, which is Craft Intelligence. Conrad and his team are working with England and Wales Cricket Board for about 5 or 6 years on the 100, which, you know, if you're a cricket fan, you know about it. It's a bit Marmite. But the truth of the 100 is, which is absolutely indisputable, is that it was valued at £1 billion last year. Wow. So they've been involved from the start, helping the ECB build a brand that's now worth £1 billion. So in our heads, if we can demonstrate that research can deliver an ROI of more than one, we're onto a winner. With that one, I mean, the numbers were just extraordinary. We started off with, okay, let's say it's 10% influence on the outcome. And they Kraft were involved at pretty much every major decision of developing that sporting brand. Then it comes to like a 500 times ROI. So, okay, well, that's a bit adventurous. Let's go for 1%. Well, that's still 50. Well, let's do 0.1%, which is like we turned up at a meeting sometime in May, you know, 2022 and said something. And that's still a 5 times ROI. So getting to the number we want to get to, particularly if you look at it not in like, it's not a clinical trial, it's let's get some back of an envelope numbers, knock them together, make some intelligent assumptions, dumb it down a little bit, you know, make it not look too boasty, because we don't want to be like the advertising industry. And it genuinely, give it a go and you'll find you'll get a story that says more than one, and often many more than one.
Totally. I think it was one of your old companies, Suzanne. eBay made a point of asking decision makers, stakeholders, for their estimate of what the insight team's contribution had been to a particular project, rather than just putting forward their own view of that. And consistently found that the stakeholders would value the insight team contribution as a percentage of the output, rather higher than the Insight team would ever dare to, you know, to suggest themselves.
Yeah.
When we did that, we often found that they hadn't really thought about it. We'd go along and say, yes, okay, you want our time and our budget, so tell me about this thing you're working on. How much money is it going to make, and how much are we going to make a difference? And some of them hadn't really thought through, and it was good for them to go back, and then they felt they were in this competition for our time and attention. And suddenly you feel really quite elevated, rather than being an order taker or a team that gets stuff done. Suddenly you're someone they really want to sell to internally, which is a great feeling.
And it makes the whole business, I think, run on a more commercial basis, doesn't it? Because if they've not thought about it, and the Insight team don't have the numbers themselves, you then talk to the finance team and you make sure that whatever numbers are coming up with together are going to add back to something that's recognised formally within the business as, you know, being part of all its revenue or cost.
You mentioned, James, it's a great way of prioritising. If you sit down and have the conversation around, this is how much money we've invested in research, and we've gone to the stakeholders to try and find out what that produced, and they literally can't come up with any numbers. Let's save our time and budget, shall we, guys? Because if you can't point to any benefit, then why are we racing around, losing our heads, trying to do the work? I mean, let's move that money somewhere else. I mean, problem is, of course, finance will come in and go, we'll have it back. But if that's a conversation, if we can't hand on heart point out to what that commercial benefit is, I think we really have to be sounding alarm bells in terms of why we're doing that work. But it's interesting you said, James, about, you know, with eBay and the internal stakeholders will often value this higher than we do, or certainly they'll value the influence that it had higher than we do. Again, I think we get quite worried and introverted around we best not say this. And I think that this initiative is to help people say it and say it louder and prouder and get out there. And once people start to think about it, and back to your original question in terms of how hard this has been, we're still getting those nerves from people, but we've also had some really good people come forward off the back of the work that we've been doing on LinkedIn. You know, people proactively saying, I really want to talk to you about this work that we did, as well as trawling the databases.
Fabulous. So tell us a bit more about your next steps, where you're hoping to get to, and how people can get involved.
So we're at the stage now where we want to get a critical mass of case studies put together. So as Danny said, we've been looking at sort of existing awards entries, mostly on the marketing side. So we're looking to get the word out, explain what we do, get more people to feel confident that some of the barriers that are going to go up, like, oh, I can't possibly give you any numbers, they're confidential, or I don't have time to do that because I don't have time to save my job. You know, we can get around all of those things, see how simple it is, the whole process, and we'll handhold people, we'll write the case studies and give people editorial sign off on all of it if that's what they want. And just get to a point where we've got a lot of these and enough to start going out and talking to our audience. So when we started all this, I think our ambition was to be at the Festival of Marketing next year, be on stage and get the message out. This is not something we think for research industry conferences. It's something outside of that. It's much bigger. And actually, in the last few weeks, I have genuinely thought about a book. You know, we sort of did a sort of slightly tongue-in-cheek post about it on LinkedIn. But I think if we can get enough great case studies together, there's actually a really good story of all the stories that could, you know, change the course of market research and the way that people, client side in particular, think about it.
So ideally, James, we are wanting people to come forward to say, I think I've got a story. And we will help them with that because it's not that difficult. It really isn't that difficult. We will help them. If there is a concern around confidentiality, we'll debrand it. We'd rather not, because we want people to be gaining the credibility for the kudos for what they've done. But if it's a real issue, then we'll debrand it. We could debrand the agency, or we could debrand the final client. We could debrand both. but we'd rather shout. It's about being loud and proud. And if people are still too nervous about that, then just get onto LinkedIn and give us a follow on Bigger Than Biscuits, because that will at least mean they start to see the sort of work that we're doing. Again, from Suzanne, what Suzanne said, it's about building a critical mass. And yeah, we want to be on the Festival of Marketing. We want to be at Cannes in 2 years' time.
Be on the beach drinking.
I want to be on the beach, but I also want to be on stage telling the advertising world that the reason that they're in Cannes celebrating is because we did a great piece of work that led to their piece of creative getting an award. And so, because I think if we're doing it in a research set, everybody's going to sit there and nod. They're just going, "Oh, this is brilliant. Oh, yeah, brilliant, brilliant, brilliant." The problem is that we're talking to ourselves, and we've got to get out there and talk to these other stakeholders.
Great. So let's issue a challenge, shall we? If everybody listening to the podcast today could think about one project that they or their colleagues have been involved in over the course of this year so far, or if it's easier to think over the course of last year, so that there's some sort of outcome metric that could be looked at. There's some business activity that's taken place as a result of the insight project, the research, the analysis that was done. If they've not followed up with stakeholders to understand what exactly came as a result of the insight team's input, then this is the moment to do so. And if everybody listening could just come up with one project and an estimated view of how much it cost for the insight team to be involved, both in terms of third-party research spend with vendors, but also the time of the insight team, the time and focus itself, and what resulted from the business impact, and then has a conversation with stakeholders in terms of, and how much of that could be attributed to the insight team's involvement, or to flip it around, how much of that wouldn't have happened if the insight team hadn't been involved in the first place, then that would just give such a great set of numbers. And if you're working with an IMA organisation already, if your company is an IMA member, we'll ask our advisors to have follow-up conversations with you. If your company is not an IMA member already, but you're inspired by this to go and think through this methodology and to think how you could come up with a number, then obviously either talk to us or talk directly to Danny and Suzanne. And let's see if together we can get to that critical mass, because we're going to be talking about disruption in the insight sector, I'm sure, certainly for the rest of this year, and I'm sure into next year and the year to come, because I don't see any sign that the headwinds that we're facing at the moment are going to come to an end in the short term. So let's all focus on really making the case for what we do, and both in terms of understanding the numbers involved, understanding commerciality, but also putting some confidence behind this and being proud of the work that we've been involved in, the difference that we've made. Thank you so much, guys. I've learned a lot today. I've been following you on LinkedIn. I've been looking at some of the case studies that Suzanne's been talking about. So if you've not seen those, Bigger Than Biscuits, follow them on LinkedIn and see if you can inspire all of us to contribute some numbers, some work, some input to this great initiative. Thanks very much.
Great. Thanks. Thanks, okay. James.
So that draws an end to today's conversation. I hope you've enjoyed it. A little bit different today. I hope you see the obvious connection to our 8th P, P for performance, and understanding the value that your insight team has contributed, and thinking about the key performance metrics that you might have in place for your team, both for this current year, looking backwards, but all importantly, for how you might set targets for next year when you're thinking about what a great 2026 might look like. Please do get in touch if you've enjoyed. Like, rate and subscribe to the show on whichever is your favourite podcast platform. And if you want further information about anything that Danny or Suzanne have said, either follow them on LinkedIn, look for Bigger Than Biscuits, or contact us at info@insight-management.org, and we can help to join the dots for you. If you've enjoyed today's conversation, then please join us next time. We'll be looking at the 9th P of the Insight Leaders Playbook, P for a personal plan. We can't achieve anything as insight leaders in terms of transforming the impact of insight within our organisations unless that we're willing to become transformational insight leaders. And that's going to mean changing the way in which we approach our roles in order to become more transformational. If that sounds relevant to you, then please join us for the next episode of the Transforming Insight podcast.
Thank you for listening. Transforming Insight is available on all leading podcast platforms. Subscribe now to get notified when the next episode is released. Check out all the resources in the show notes and sign up to our email list. The Transforming Insight podcast is brought to you by the Insight Management Academy, who reserves the rights to the content. For more information on any of the ideas discussed in the episode, please visit www.insight-management.org.